visit a land like no other. An extraordinary land where you can lose yourself and be who you want to be. Escape to Wonder.Land.
Vodafone, proudly supporting Wonder.Land. A brand new musical with music from Damon Albarn. Book tickets now at nationaltheatre.org.uk. Vodafone. Power to you.
Blog Talk Radio.
Mid-South or Memphis or 80s Jim Crockett. And I've always kind of pushed the 90s promotions to the side. And for as long as I've known you, you've always said that you've had a soft spot in your heart for ECW. And so I want you to tell the people, you know, about how you came to find this company and how you came to grow into loving it so much.
Yes, the people. I love ECW. It's probably my favorite of all time promotion. I like Crockett 1985, 86, 87 a lot, too. I like Mid-South, but I might like it less after the 80s set, believe it or not. And it's a really weird statement to make, but, like, I loved it a lot, but the matches were all a lot slower paced than I remembered, like, as a kid. Like, watching the TV show, like, Power Pro and stuff, like, it was always action, action, action. So, like, I think that ultimately Mid-South takes a back step to Crockett, and ECW is probably my number one favorite promotion of all time. Man, I don't even know what to say. Like, I remember when I first discovered it, it was in, like, an After Mag, and they would run bar shows in, like, 1992, 93, and it was in the wake of Joel Goodhart's promotion burning out. So, like, I was like, ECW, Eastern Championship Wrestling, why do they run in bars? That's crazy. And they had guys I knew, like DC Drake and people like that. So they weren't necessarily the best wrestlers in the world at all at that time. But when Eddie Gilbert showed up, I liked that. I liked that they used guys like Morocco and Terry Funk and stuff. And then, obviously, Pauline came in and blew the roof off the joint. But, man, ECW, it was good timing on ECW's part when it came about.
Well, Rob, tonight we have a special guest, and I think he's probably seen more ECW than any human alive. So why don't you do us a favor and introduce tonight's special guest?
Oh, shit, yeah, we got live with us tonight, former Ring of Honor booker and my favorite Ring of Honor booker, by the way, Dragon Gate USA booker mastermind, Evolve 2. We got Gabe Sapolsky with us. What's up, Gabe?
Yo, what's up?
How's it going, man? We're talking ECW, dude. When was the first time you saw ECW right off the bat?
The first time I saw ECW, it was one of the Cabrini College TV tapings, and it was terrible. It was before Paulie took over as booker. And it was bad. I don't remember all the details. Terry Funk was there, I think. Jimmy Snuka might have been there. I think Paulie was there. Eddie Gilbert was there, of course. And then, of course, all the local guys. There's about 30, 40 people in the crowd. And me and my friend left, and we were just like, wow, this is bad.
How about any of the bar shows? Did you go any of the infamous bar
shows?
I
was actually at Temple during the time of many of those bar shows, and I wanted to go, but I couldn't find anyone to go with me, so I didn't go to any of them because I still couldn't bring myself to go venture away from the Temple University campus by my lonesome, so I did not go to any of them.
There you go. Yeah, I was telling Will before you were on the line that the guy that actually drew me to ECW initially was DC Mad Dog Drake, who obviously is a super name in the wrestling business that everyone remembers, but he was a big name, and he came to Shamokin when I was a little kid. I was like, oh, shit, Larry Winters and DC Drake. This was, but it wasn't very good initially, like you said. Paulie came in and went shithouse and turned it into what we all know and love. But I was going to say the number one wrestler to me that really kickstarted my ECW fandom and addiction, definitely Sabu. I mean, he was the guy that all the tape traders loved at the time, the small amount of them that there were at the time. You were right there when Sabu came in. What were your memories of when Sabu first showed up in ECW, and had you seen him prior to ECW? I'm guessing you did.
Yeah, I mean, I think I might have seen him. I mean, actually, it was at that Autumn Armageddon card with the Sheik and Abdul the Butcher. He was, like, dude doing a run-in. And, you know, I'm sure I saw a clip of him or two from FMW. But, yeah, that first night was something else when Sabu made his debut. I mean, I still vote for Sabu every year in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame ballot. I might be the only one still voting for him. As long as he's on the ballot, I will vote for him because for that one-year period or however long it was when he first came into ECW and, did his thing, man, like, ECW would not have taken off without Sabu. I mean, I firmly believe that. You know, it was, by the time he had the falling out with Paulie and left and everything, they had already kind of established the brand and the vibe and, like, you know, Public Enemy was established at that point and Dreamer and Sandman and that kind of stuff. But at the very beginning, like, Sabu, like, was needed for that company to take off and really define the style and make ECW something different. And it all started with that first night, that moment they unhooked him from the gurney. In fact, once again, maybe there are 40, 50 people, 60, 70 people, something like that at that show. It was one of the first shows at the arena. And he started throwing chairs everywhere, and you can see John Clark, who's now a very well-known sportscaster here in Philadelphia, running away. That's when he was doing the wrestling flyer and everything. And I remember from that moment that they unhooked him, and he just went crazy throwing chairs everywhere and everything. Like, we were all hooked. Like, we were all like, man, this is, like, something else. And that's what Sabu was. I mean, yeah, I had to be there at the time, like, I hate to say it now, but you really had to be there at the time to understand, like, how much Sabu meant. But like I said, I mean, for that one-year period, or however long it was, it might have only been 6 months before he had his falling out with Paulie. I forget exactly. But, I'll vote for him for the Hall of Fame every single year just based off of that because none of this would have happened without him during that period.
Yeah, I remember, of all people, I remember Hunter Q. Robbins III had a horrible promo. Like, people remember the Kennedy assassination. I remember the first time I saw Sabu because Hunter Q. Robbins had a promo. It ended, and then all of a sudden they're like, Sabu. And they had a picture of him in FMW in an outdoor show doing a moonsault from the top rope onto, like, Lenny St. Clair, who was on a table breaking facial bones in his face. And he, like, flew all around to the third row. I'd never seen anything like it. I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? I immediately had to get all the tapes. I'd probably join your Sabu fan club, I'm pretty sure, but I just remember immediately loving all of his stuff, finding all of his matches, and you're right, that match with Taz was fucking incredible.
Wasn't the first thing, maybe the first thing, I forget whether the match was first. There's two things that weekend, there's a match and there's an angle, and the angle he did, like, the big moonsault to the floor and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I forget which one was first, but it was a combination of those two things, and it just blew everybody away, and then, like, you know, the crowds just grew from that point on. I mean, they really did.
Yeah, he could be in the ring with, like, the Rocket
Brothers. I
want to
ask you real quick. Hold on, Rob. Gabe, I want to ask you. Now, Sabu has had a lot of famous feuds in ECW, you know, or famous matches. You know, he did the barbed wire match with Terry Funk. He feuded with RVD after being tag partners. What's your favorite Sabu feud in ECW?
I mean, probably like the, you know, that Terry Funk feud with something else. I mean, it's hard to say, man. I wish that him and Benoit really had that, like, proper match. I don't think they ever really had the proper match. The Scorpio matches were awesome back then, too. Two gold Scorpio matches. I mean, it's hard to, like, Sabu, it didn't really matter who his opponent was. I mean, you're paying to see Sabu, and Sabu was going to do his thing, no matter who his opponent was. Cactus Jack. Like, you can't forget that. That was only a couple of matches. They had that one awesome one in Hamburg with the bottle.
I was there.
Yeah, like, you know, you can't get away with that nowadays, but, I mean, now it's just absolutely ridiculous. And then they had that match in Philly at the arena, which I remember they tried to tell a story in, and I remember everyone's a little bit disappointed in it at the time. But that Hamburg one was just insane. And Public Enemy, I mean, they were all good, because Sabu, like, it didn't matter who he was in there with, like, it was always entertaining.
Yeah, I like the way Paulie presented Sabu, too. Like, Sabu's wrestled everywhere. But it was just a magical combination because Paulie knew how to present him, kind of. Like, I remember before the Cactus Jack match in Philly even was announced, the whole TV show was based around who's going to face Cactus? Is it going to be Onita? Is it going to be Stan Hansen? And they kept throwing out names. And then at the end, they just showed Cactus going bang, bang. It's like, what the fuck? And it's like, what an amazing match that's going to be. And that was like the week of the OJ chase, I think, too. But I just remember that week in 94 being freaking nuts. But Sabu's the fucking man. As Gabe said, he was the guy who everyone would buy a ticket to see. Like, I think that has to be noted, because Sabu was the guy who, if he was on a pay-per-view, and that didn't happen until later, but if he's on a pay-per-view, I'd buy that pay-per-view. Him and Rey Mysterio were always those guys for me at the time. But, like, Sabu was just all super creative, had killer matches with everyone from, like, I was almost at Steve Corino, but Stevie Richards, Mikey Whipwreck, up and down the card, just kicking ass all the time. And that match with Scorpio that Gabe noted had the crazy chair jump, fucking flip plancha into the fifth row, destroying the table in like 150 pieces. He's just the fucking man. The only match he ever had I didn't like was probably with Mr. Hughes. So that's about it.
I love Sabu.
Gabe, there's a real famous Sabu match. Sabu and Bobby Eaton versus Terry Funk and Arn Anderson. And whenever I've heard the shoot interviews or heard Arn Anderson speak about it, he always says that, you know, when him and Eaton got there, that Sabu and Funk were trying to show them up by doing all the high spots and trying to ruffle the ECW style. Now, my own personal opinion, and I've seen Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton in bloodbaths, street fights, you know, garbage brawls, you know, from the 80s. And I don't really buy that. You know, where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I remember about the match is it happened to be the one match that my dad was in town for, and he's not a wrestling fan, but he was there that night. And I do remember that. And I do remember coming out of the match and thinking it was a little bit disappointing. I don't remember why, and I don't remember much about the match. But, yeah, so I guess I really can't say more than that about it because that's all I remember.
What about you, Rob?
I just remember it being really cool that Bobby Eaton and Arn Anderson were there, and everybody was kind of like, you know, this is going to be amazing because, you know, everybody was marking out for Eaton and Anderson and Funk and Sabu. I mean, those were like, you know, four of the all-time heroes of the hardcore diehard fans of the time. And the match was decent, but, like, it wasn't anything sensational. I don't know why, you know. That was at that time in my life, I was just an awe to be part of all of this. So I wasn't really, you know, privy to all the details of everything.
Yeah, I don't remember the match either, but I remember, like, the music video for the videotape that they play a million times. It was, like, Ministry or the Cults playing behind. And, like, yeah, well, I think they had, like, Funk pile driving Sabu through, like, a broken table or some shit. But I always loved the music videos. Music was so key to ECW, in my opinion. Like, man, it's just one of those perfect timing things where ECW came about, maybe a little bit before the copyright craze, and, like, maybe Paul Lee was able to sneak some stuff under the radar. Maybe Paul Lee had access in New York with different people to you know, sign off on using music. I don't know what Gabe thinks, but would you agree with that, how music was just so prime a part
of... Yeah, I mean, the music was important, you know. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It was a huge part of things. And again, like you said, you know, it came before everything, you know, had to be copywritten. And then I think Pauly pretty much ignored it once everyone started going after him, too, because it was sometime during the course of ECW when all that copy, when, you know, people started going after the copyright music and all that. So, you know, it was, music was definitely a huge part of it and, you know, extremely important.
Yeah, Paul Lee, like, it's so weird because the way the TV was, like he got, like, underground hip-hop guys like J-Ru the Damager would be on the ECW TV complete with, like, the whole music video and the record company. And I'm like, wow, what's this all about? And I'd find these people and find cassette tapes at the time to age me a little bit here. And, like, I would listen to all this music just because it was on freaking ECW. I really love the whole music connection. Paulie's ear, whoever was in Paulie's ear with the music, was really on point. It was always a really good blend with the wrestling that was presented, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, the music completely set the tone. You know, it was really important. I mean, Enter Sandman, all that Public Enemies theme song. I mean, all that stuff, you can't take that stuff away.
Great. Okay, guys.
It's actually disappointing. I do remember it was actually kind of disappointing when we had that ECW album come out, and, you know, everyone was kind of in amazement that, you know, that this company grew to the point that it was having its own album. But then, like, you know, all the songs were kind of lame compared to what we were used to. So, you know, that was a little bit of a downer, but it was super cool. I mean, you look back and you think about it. I mean, there's an ECW album, you know, that was actually distributed and pushed. And, I mean, I remember going to Tower Records and ECW.
Uh-oh.
Did we lose Gabe?
Gabe got cut out. Gabe may have been cut out, but I also remember going to Tower Records, motherfuckers, and finding that album, and it was just really bad, as Gabe said. I remember really wanting to like it. I think there wasn't a Ronnie James Dio song on it, but Mike Awesome's theme, I forget who it's by. God, help me here. Not Dio. You have to watch it. But, yeah, they had horrible bands like the band Grinspoon. And all other kind of shitty bands as well.
Yeah, or you'd have Shane Douglas had Deep Purple's Perfect Strangers. And Deep Purple hadn't had a significant song since, you know, the 1970s, you know. So
yeah, I remember watching a tape of Shane Douglas, and they had Perfect Strangers playing. And, like, my mom walked around, like, near my room, and she's like, good tune. I'm like, oh, my God, ECW's bringing back songs of my mom, like, back in the 70s, you know. It was just crazy to me, like. But, like, that album did suck. That was such a funny correlation.
It's kind of weird, Rob, because my cue is showing that Gabe is still with us. Gabe, can you hear us? No? Well, Gabe, if you can hear us, he cannot hear you. If you can, hang up, call back, and we'll definitely get you back on the line. But that was kind of weird.
Gabe has been silenced. It's very unfortunate, as I was really getting into that ECW Greenspoon discussion and all those other terrible bands.
Here we go.
Yeah,
we got him back, Rob. Gabe, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Hey, okay. We were just discussing Greenspoon while you were gone. But, yeah, that horrible album ECW had. You went to Tower Records and were super impressed, I think.
I was just saying it was lame, man. You know, like, in the end, like...
Okay, you were not impressed. You hated it.
Yeah, like, you know, the cover songs of everything. You know, you had, like, Justin Credible's music was a cover song now, and I forget what else, but, like, you know, I think they got Monster Magnet on there, which is crazy. And the craziest thing is the Europe version of the album had an Iron Monkey song on, which is like an obscure sludge band that I used to listen to back in the day, and now it's kind of nuts. But besides that, once you start getting to those covers, and, you know, I remember Mike Awesome's music being particularly lame, and...
What? I will disagree with you on that one. I love Mike Awesome's theme.
But, yeah, I mean, that was definitely, like, a little bit of a shift, you know, because it went from being this cool kind of underground thing to, like, you know, here's this album of all these covers and everything. But it was quite an accomplishment that album even happened in the first place.
Okay, serious question. Which album was better, the ECW album or the WCW album?
I don't think I ever listened to the WCW album, so I can't tell you that. But like, I think by default,
the WCW album is the worst album of all time. Damn, that song about Justin Rhodes with the Natural and all these other terrible songs. Total shit. And the Freebird song even sucks. So, yeah, come on, Will. Terrible
yeah.
comparison.
Yeah, I think it was a setup question. Well, anyway, Gabe, now, you know, Rob brought up Sabu, and we've mentioned Sandman, and, you know, we've heard these guys, Tommy Dreamer, Raven. I mean, these guys were the core of ECW. They were, you know, they were the engine that made it run for so long. But tonight we'd like to talk about some guys that, are, you know, maybe they just had a temporary run in ECW or they kind of flew under the radar. You know, we're talking about guys like Austin and Pillman who were just there, you know, they you know, had a cup of coffee and then they split, or maybe guys like Ron Simmons, Sid, Scott Hall, the Steiner brothers, Tully Blanchard. You know, were there any of these guys you thought that when you saw them in ECW, you just thought, man, these guys are out of their element. You know, they shouldn't be here. Or other guys, you know, obviously probably Austin and Pillman, where you thought, man, I just wish they would have stuck around longer and just had some great feuds.
Well, Austin and Pillman were obviously the two that you wanted to stick around longer. I mean, they were, you know, you saw the charisma, and they could obviously have worked
yeah.
the style and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think Paul really figured either of them would be around for that long anyways. So I think he figured he'd get what he could out of them and get some attention and, you know, give some rub to some people from them and everything. So I don't think he had any plans. Tully Blanchard was a disaster because, of course, that one match with Shane Douglas at the arena is legendary for
uh-huh.
being how awful it was. With the fans actually turning their back on the match, which is the only time I can remember that happening. But what people really don't remember is there was a small house show outside of Philadelphia, I want to say northeast Philly. I almost want to say it was at a Catholic school, which would seem odd, so maybe it wasn't. But I can still picture the building, but I can kind of picture the outside of the building. I can completely picture the inside of it. There weren't a lot of people there, and I believe Tully was working Shane Douglas on that show, perhaps in a rematch or something. And I remember them actually getting a legit fight in the locker room, which I did not see. I was kicked out of the locker room and not allowed in while the fight was going on. But, yeah, so that kind of sucked. It might have even been over doing a job or something, too. So Tully Blanchard's run was definitely a disaster. Let's see, who else was there? Like Ron Simmons, I mean, he was just there for a show or two. I think he was on loan from WCW at the time. So it was cool. It was something a little bit different. I don't know why they picked Ron Simmons, why Paul would pick Ron Simmons of all people, just because he was never really super over at the hardcores. And, you know, Sid and Scott Hall, I mean, that was towards, you know, the late years when things weren't quite as good as they used to be.
Man, I love Ron Simmons. Ron Simmons and Too Cold had some race-baiting promos that were so good before November to Remember 1990-something. Holy shit. Everyone, if you have the TV tapes, go back and watch them. Ron Simmons in the ring, and not so much. And the fans turned on him in 9-1-1 as well. So Ron Simmons didn't click, but the promos were awesome with Too Cold Scorpio playing the Martin Lawrence role. But aside from that, the one guy I always wanted to be in ECW who I thought would have been huge, Big Titan, Rick Wagner. He had a horrible match with Sabu, right? But I honestly think he could have been like a Mike Awesome level. Shut up. He could have been a Mike Awesome level guy for ECW. Same with the Headhunters. The Headhunters, the Gladiator Mike Awesome, and Big Titan should have been fucking huge. One out of the four was. So I thought the other guys were going to really kick some ass too, and it just
yeah,
really
I mean,
didn't work out.
I remember the Headhunters. I mean, I think that was a Victor Quinones deal where Paul never really trusted Victor enough to give the Headhunters a push. And maybe Victor was pulling something to deserve that. I wouldn't be surprised. So I think that was the downfall of the Headhunters coming in and having any kind of a run, although I might be incorrect about that, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. And, yeah, Big Titan, I don't know what happened to him. I really have nothing to add when it comes to Big Titan. But Mike Awesome, if you remember.
Yeah, you and me both, man.
He had that awesome match against JT Smith at the three-way dance show. In 1994, and then he disappeared for a while. Maybe he had Japan and everything. And then he came back with a push. So it would have been pretty awesome if Mike Awesome had stuck around back in 1994. I think that he could have really done some cool stuff back then. And on the subject of JT Smith, let's talk about JT Smith, perhaps the most unheralded member.
You're making my segues easy, Gabe.
Am I skipping ahead here? Because we can't.
No, man, you're making it easy, man. You're helping me with my segues. You keep talking, man.
I mean, you cannot talk about ECW without talking about JT Smith, because number one, he was the dude back in the early days before Paulie came along that was kind of keeping everything together as far as being a really good in-ring performer and doing crazy stuff and out there promoting too. I mean, he was a big part of the behind the scenes and everything. And, you know, I remember him falling off that scaffold and, you know, he didn't take the bump the way everybody else took that scaffold bump. You know, he walked off the scaffold and that was, I think, the Ultra Class show. And, you know, he was a main guy back then for Philadelphia. And he was, you know, JT was a good friend of mine, too. He still is. I've neglected the friendship. I got to call him. But I remember just, like, JT was working at Todd's store at the time when I was there, and we'd go out for lunch and stuff. And no matter where you went in the city with JT Smith, he'd bump into somebody that he knew. He was just that kind of guy. And so he was a big part in the early days of ECW, making it happen and making things happen. And that tends to get forgotten in the history of everything. I would say if you were to ask me who's the number one neglected name in the history of ECW, I would say JT Smith, without a doubt. You know, he did a lot back then, and he took a lot of punishment. I mean, I feel bad for the dude. You know, he took a lot of headshots. He had a lot of concussions. And you know, stuff that wouldn't happen nowadays, and he did that hoping for a payoff, and it never happened for him, unfortunately. And to me, that's really tragic. You know, Perry Saturn broke his jaw at a show in Plymouth Meeting. I'm not going to go on record saying it was on purpose, but I'm very suspicious that it was done on purpose, because there's definitely a Philadelphia clique and a New York clique at the time, and that was pretty much it for JT. You know, I think his wife, he had to miss time, and his wife was upset over the whole situation and made him quit, which is probably for the best, because he probably just would have taken about another 1,000 unprotected chair shots, and, you know, who knows what his brain would be like right now if that had happened. But at the same time, you know, you had a lot of guys from ECW go on to make a lot of money in various places, and JT should have been one of those guys, and it didn't happen. And it's, you know, it's really not right. It really is one of those things that's just not right.
Yeah, well, JT Smith. Will, can I go on about JT a second real quick?
Yeah, of course, Will.
JT Smith was a dude who was, like, the first U.S. guy I ever saw do, like, a Northern Lights suplex. He was really into that whole Japanese scene before most people that were in U.S. wrestling. He had a lot of awesome moves, but he was also amazing, as Gabe said, at making other people just shine and look so much better. Like he said earlier, the Mike Awesome match, Jesus Christ, probably one of my top 10 favorite ECW matches of all time, just for sheer cringe, oh my God, what the fuck is going on? It really typified ECW, because there was so much craziness in that match. That's over-the-top rope breaking the spine tope, the rope breaking, referees getting fucked up, unbelievable stuff. JT Smith lands on his freaking head taking a crazy clothesline bump. Unbelievable match. JT Smith was also awesome in the FBI when he turned little Guido into an Italian somehow, and he had all those promos where he would be singing Frank Sinatra songs, which, not oddly enough, CM Punk in Reading on Sunday at the show I was at was singing a Sinatra song about Chicago before his match, bringing back JT Smith to me about 15 years earlier in you know, Pennsylvania, doing the same thing. So yeah, JT Smith was the fucking man. He's probably my third or second favorite member of the FBI too.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, to me, unfortunate that a lot of people do remember him just for the comedy gimmick with the FBI and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to come out and say he's the world's greatest worker. He was a phenomenal seller. He had a good offense. And unfortunately, you know, something always went wrong in his matches, and it wasn't something he didn't purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that tope in the Hack Myers match where he landed on his head, which was absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was just one of these guys that there would be, like, a big fuck-up in his matches here and there. And unfortunately, maybe that did hold him back in the eyes of Paulie, I don't know. But, you know, when it came to selling, he was about as believable of a seller as there is, you know. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people do remember him just for the FBI thing, which I don't think it's how he wants to be remembered, but, you know, that's where he gained his most notoriety and everything. But JT was, he was the dude back then, you know. When ECW was getting started, he was the guy doing that stuff that nobody else was doing. He was the guy taking huge chances. He was taking huge bumps. And, you know, I really wish it had paid off for him more.
Go on.
No doubt. Oh, yeah. From JT Smith, we shall go another route here. Favorite tag team in ECW history? Like, there's so many you could pick from. I'll go first, and I'll say my favorite tag team in ECW was Rob Van Dam and Sabu. Granted, their matches weren't pretty sometimes. But to me, like, you put those two crazy motherfuckers together, I just was always going to buy the tape, buy the, you know, the fan cam, or buy the pay-per-view they were on. Now, I like, honestly, are they a better team overall, in my opinion, at everything with tag team wrestling than PG-13? Probably not. But for me at the time, I just loved watching them fly around and be crazy. Their matches with, like, Storm and Candido, I always really liked. And their matches with the Dudleys were always really good, too. So I would say that Rob Van Dam and Sabu, my favorite tag team in ECW, for sure.
Oh, yeah, I mean, they were always entertaining, no doubt about that. And, I mean, I'm going to have to go with a team. I don't know how this stuff holds up today because I haven't watched them so long. It probably doesn't hold up that well. But, I mean, the Eliminators were absolutely awesome back then. And they were just an amazing tag team, the stuff that they could do, especially Cronus as a big man and Perry Saturn as a more grounded guy. And, you know, Cronus really needed to be babysat by Saturn, and that drove Saturn crazy. Mm-hmm. So I know that was, you know, part of the dynamic there outside the ring. But, I mean, inside the ring, I mean, they were just doing super cool stuff. And I remember, like, you know, that Barely Legal pay-per-view, it started out with the Eliminators coming out with the Dudleys. And I know for a fact, you know, they went over that. The match was like a series of, like, 8 or 10 spots or something. And mm-hmm. they went over all 8 or 10 spots like a million times up at the ECW school up in Long Island or wherever it was up in New York. And, you know, it was just a super cool match. Like, no one could touch their double teams at the time. And Paul, you know, did a great job protecting them, and they were an absolutely phenomenal team. You know, you asked me for my favorite tag team. I mean, you know, thinking off the top of my head, the first name I think of is the Eliminators. And, you know, Public Enemy, you tend to forget about Public Enemy. When you think about Public Enemy now, people, you know, you think about the WCW time or when they came back to ECW and it was a total flop. But, I mean, they were a huge part of the ECW success back in 1995 before they left. I mean, they were a huge act and a huge reason that ECW became successful. And, you know, especially when Sabu left. When Sabu left, they just completely picked up that slack and were really a huge thing as far as keeping the fans that wanted the blood and the tables and the violence and everything. I mean, now it's all Public Enemy. And two really super good guys, too. I remember, like, Ted Petty giving me a ride back from Todd Storr back to 1994, way back, as just some scrawny little kid, you know, stopping at Gino's, buying me a cheesesteak, just all-around super good guy, Ted Petty, and Johnny Crunch. The first time I ever went on the road was on a trip to Florida, and I came down with, like, they gave me, like, two huge duffel bags full of shirts, and they're like, you're doing the merch for the weekend, and I might have been 1990, yeah, I think it was 1994, I want to say. I don't think it was 1995 yet, but they're just like, you're going to Florida, we're buying you a plane ticket, there's two giant duffel bags of merch. And I remember landing in the airport, and actually Sabu, like, landed, we just bumped into a baggage claim, and he could tell, you know, I was about 145 pounds at the time, maybe, and Sabu picking up one of the bags of the shirt and carrying it for me because he could tell I was just dying at the time and everything. So that was cool. But I was rooming with the sound dude at the time, and Johnny Grunge, like, showed up at the door and, like, banged on the door and everything. And I was like, oh, shit, Johnny Grunge. And this is I was a very naive kid at the time, very naive 22-year-old at the time. And Grunge was like, you ready to go out to, like, the sound dude? And they were like, yeah, you know, sound dude was like, yeah. And then Grunge turned to me, he's like, you want to go out and find some coke? And I was like, no. And then just kind of sat at the hotel for the rest of the time there. So that was pretty much my Johnny Grunge story. But it was cool for him to offer, you know. Like, he didn't know and he made the offer, you know. So that was cool. So those guys were super good. You know, they both treated me really well back in the day and everything. Grunge was definitely more of the goofball than Teddy, but Teddy was like a super, super nice guy, like both of them.
Well, let me ask you this, since you brought them up. You know, I mean, obviously people look at their WCW run and, you know, they look at it as kind of a failure. Now, let me ask you this. If you thought that the Eliminators could have held it together, you know, because, you know, when Saturn came into WCW, he went in with Raven as part of the flock. Okay. If you thought that the Eliminators could go to WCW, do you think that they would have made an impact there, or do you think that they would have probably gotten the public enemy treatment as well?
I mean, there's no telling, you know. I mean, a lot of the ECW magic was how Paul presented everybody. I mean, he knew exactly how to present this talent. He knew when to edit, what to edit. So, you know, it's hard to tell. I think Saturn would have been fine. And Saturn, I don't know, maybe he did. He had a decent run, right? Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just curious.
Yeah, Saturn was a really
solid
wrestler. You know, I don't know about, you know, Cronus. Cronus, you know, was definitely received most of his gifts, you know, on the athletic physical side of life. And, you know, so I don't know how he would have done in that environment. But, and Cronus was a good guy, too, don't get me wrong. He was another guy that was always super cool to me. You know, I don't know if he knew my name or not, but he was always cool to me. But, you know, so I don't know what they would have done in WCW. But I guess it's Saturn. Saturn was smart enough, dude, to, you know how to get him politically. And it seemed like, you know, he had a good little run there, too.
Yeah, I think the Olympics would have done well there, but there's no El Puerto Ricanio or Joel Hartgood there to, like, take all their crazy shit. Because, like, Paul Lee always found a way to put them with the right people, too, as far as just massacres, you know? So I really liked all their – I used to like when they did the Doomsday Device and with the chair shot to the head. That was pretty awesome. But and they had a really – their debut match was with, like, Chad Allen and some other dude. And I remember their debut match, they debuted, like, 15 different tag team spots I had never seen before. I don't think that match has ever aired in its entirety. But like you said, Paul Lee just chopped it all up, and the clips on the TV, I remember Meltzer calling them mini Road Warriors combined with, like, Hase and Sasaki or something. Like, what? Like, well, I got to see these guys. So I remember getting the tape of it and just being, like, blown away just at, like, this wimpy match that they had. But, yeah, man, Olympus is a really good second choice for me, too, as far as tag teams and ECW.
Well, I don't know where y'all stand on my favorite tag team of ECW, but I've been watching a lot of Tracy Smothers lately, and I have absolutely fallen in love with the FBI, with Smothers and Guido, and especially with Tommy Rich on the outside, just generating the most heat that any manager of the 90s ever generated. You know, Smothers inside the ring was great. Guido inside was great. With Tommy Rich, you know, just the entire crowd, whether it's on a fan cam or, you know, on a TV show or one of the big shows. And here's your, you know, your mid-level comedy act generating this mad heat, you know, large part because, you know, Smothers and Guido could bring it in the ring, but also because Tommy Rich was just out there just antagonizing the entire crowd. What are your thoughts on the FBI run there? I know we talked about briefly with J.T. Smith, but what about the other guys in the FBI?
I mean, they were decent. I got to admit, I was never a huge FBI fan or anything, you know, and that's not a knock on any of the guys, wrestlers or anything. I just, you know, always saw them as kind of like a mid-card comedy act, and that really wasn't my thing. So, you know, I wasn't quite as high on them as you, but they were all super cool guys. So, and, you know, they're all very talented. They're all great wrestlers, obviously. So it doesn't take away any of that. It's just a matter of personal taste, I would say.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like, my FBI was Mama Luke and Guido. Like, I thought that their shit toward the end was ridiculous. Tracy Smothers is one of these guys I probably should like way more than I do, but I just don't. Like, I like Tracy Smothers a lot more, like, with the Young Pistols and the Southern Boys back in the day, but there was always something that I just never really was, like, seeking out Tracy Smothers or buying a ticket to see Tracy Smothers. Now, Guido, I thought Guido was fucking awesome because he took crazy bumps all the time, and he was pretty good at being, like, the little shit-kicker character. So I liked him, too, but I'm the same way now. Tommy Rich I love. Tommy Rich is probably...
Guido and Mama Luke were awesome. I'm still a fan of that tag team. I mean, you know, I really like the Guido Mama Luke team. And, of course, Mikey and Tajiri were awesome, too, as a tag team.
I think you guys are
missing the boat. And I just want to bring up my favorite FBI moment is right after Frank Sinatra. And they beat the piss out of Blue Meanie and Noah. And Tommy Rich kept shouting, "This one's for Frank," you know, or you know, just and left them a bloody mess. And like you said, they were this mid-card comedy act that just showed this viciousness that they'd never shown before. And it just really just stuck in my head, you know, to this day. So,
yeah.
You know.
We know it sticks in my head. Trying to die.
I'm okay with that.
Trying to die Tony Mameluke was really dope, too. Like, when he would just take headers into guardrails and stuff. Now, granted, it's post-Benoit, and I'm not allowed to say I'm enjoying these things, but back at the time, I thought that shit was awesome. Like, I don't know. Like, again, I know you're not supposed to, but holy shit. Tony Mameluke would take the worst fucking beatings in the history of wrestling, and, like, he would sell Tajiri's kicks like it was fucking craziness. Like, him and Jack Evans were, like, the two most bendy human beings I think I've ever seen as far as taking legit ass kicking. So, Tony Mameluke.
I think they did more damage to Tony Mameluke in the power plant at WCW than he did. But I do have a story about the crazy bumps. The first Tony Mameluke debut, which was in, I believe it was Dayton, Ohio, somewhere in Ohio in a big building. I think it was Dayton. Toledo. It was one of those towns. Anyways, it was his debut, and he just took the craziest bump from, like, it was on the apron or on the turnbuckle or something to the floor into the first row or something. And I just remember Paul, like, that's one of his job. Paul saw the bump and was like, oh, my God, that was crazy. And then Paul kept telling me, like, oh, he did that on purpose. He did that on purpose. And then I went and I asked Tony Mameluke about it years later, I think, and Mameluke denies doing that bump on purpose. And I think people out there, if they've seen the bump, they probably remember it. But Heyman is convinced Mameluke did it on purpose to win himself a job, which did get him a job, but Mameluke denies doing it on purpose. So that's my Tony Mameluke story. But once again, those matches with where it's him and Guido against Tajiri and Mikey, I mean, I still love those matches. I think they'll hold up today, too. You know,
they
I don't know how much the ECW stuff will hold up today, but I think those matches will definitely hold up today.
Yeah, that famous Hammerstein debut for ECW, both nights of that, those matches definitely hold up. I've always liked night one a little better. Were you the guy that fan cammed that stuff? Because
those fan cams are fucking tremendous.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, those shows were absolutely amazing. They were great shows. They're just, you know, top to bottom, just absolutely fantastic shows.
Now, Gabe. You know, we talk about guys who hold up, and somebody who's kind of gotten an internet renaissance here is Too Cold Scorpio. And I've really enjoyed a lot of the stuff I've seen from him. But I'm kind of curious, you know, I mean, you were there before he went to WWF, and then when he came back after his WWF run. I mean, were there any differences that you noticed in Scorp, or was it the same old, you know, let's put in the work rate and
He's always about going out there and working hard. I mean, you know, he's always about going out there, putting in his time, working hard, and doing his thing. You know, I remember, you know, eavesdropping in when him and Paulie were talking back in the day and him wanting to, you know, I remember one show, it was at Drexel. There was a house show Drexel, which actually was promoted by John Clark, I believe, now of Philadelphia sports broadcaster fame. And forget who was working that night, but Paul was like, what do you feel like going tonight? Like, you know, 8, 10, and Scorpio was like, I'm just getting warmed up 8 minutes in. And, like, you know, he kept that attitude all the way until when we had him on the first DG USA show. So he's all about working hard, going out there, doing his thing, and giving the people their money's worth.
Yeah, I was there that night at the Dragon Gate show, the first show, and I absolutely loved that Scorpio. I know it probably didn't fit with the theme of the show or not, but I absolutely, you know, thought it was
a really good match, too. It just was a little out of place, you know. We were still kind of finding our bearings. So it's the first Dragon Gate show. We were trying to bring in Scorpio to try to bring in, you know, a few different fans, give them a name that they would know, and I want to see what Ken Doan brought to the table. But, yeah, I mean, it was a good match, you know. It was kind of a little out of context on the show, but, you know, but the match proved that Scorpio, you know, is willing to put his time in and willing to work hard and still has it.
Yeah, his music was fucking awesome on that show, too. And another quick Scorpio shout to plug TNA of all things. Scorpio and C.W. Anderson was fucking ridiculously awesome on TNA's awesome ECW pay-per-view. Like, that was, like, the saving grace of that entire show. I was very happy that Scorpio had such a good match. I actually thought Scorpio in 2000-ish was really sluggish in ECW, and I thought he kind of got his groove back in, like, the mid or, you know, early 2000s, but maybe it's just me. But I remember he had a match with Masato Tanaka, which I fucking hated. I just, like, oh, what the fuck? So, like, two of my favorite guys, and they had this match at the arena that was just fucking brutal. But, like, overall, I will agree that Scorpio, he usually always brought it in ECW. He's one of my favorite guys, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, his whole role might have been a little bit underrated when you look back at it, because he wrestled a lot of different people and had a lot of matches and a lot of good stuff in there. You know, his tag team with Sandman was really good, too. I mean, they had a good run, and who would have thought, you know, Sandman, Scorpio, what a, you know, it's kind of a odd tag team because, you know, the wrestling styles there don't really mesh, but they ended up making it work, and it was a really good team.
Yeah, and the Heat, man, I watched a recent match, them against the Headhunters from, like, one of the first New York shows, and holy fuck, when, like, Scorpio would dance and, like, make Sandman dance, and then Scorpio would drink, and then they had two belts, and two gold Scorpio, and Slutty Missy Hyatt was with them getting beer poured all over her tits. Like, that was just a fun act to watch, like, looking back on it at the time, like, 1996, yeah, six, I think it was. Late
yeah, I mean, they weren't about to pull off any, you know, cool double teams or anything, but you know, I guess it'll work that it was like a, you know, it's a really fun act. And I guess whatever Sandman's weaknesses were, Scorpio made up for, and well, whatever Sandman's weaknesses were, Scorpio made up for in the ring. So it was a really, you know, it was a really entertaining act. And I believe Nancy Sullivan was with them for a little while too. And you know, she was a great part of the act. I remember one night with them trying to make her dance, and you know, she was not a very good dancer, although extremely lovely and kind person.
There you go.
Wow. That's wild. And now, you know, we got off on Scorpio and elaborated there, but I was going to segue with, speaking of Japanese guys, you know, coming to Philadelphia, you know, after our Dragon talk, ECW was known for bringing a lot of Japanese guys in. I mean, Osama Nishimura came in early, Kanemura, Hidaka, you know, all the Michinoku Pro guys. You know, how were they treated in the ECW locker room? And, like, how did they adjust to being in America? Because I can't imagine that most of them knew English, or if they did, it was very little. I mean, what was your vibe with the Japanese guys that came over?
I mean, the late, great Doug Gentry played a big role in that, so we usually ended up driving with a lot of the guys. You know, we drove with Kenimura and Tanaka and Tajiri, you know, stayed with us basically. You know, Tajiri stayed at my parents' house several times and stuff. And so, you know, they never fully were, like, hanging out with the boys and all that kind of stuff because, like, when we traveled, we didn't really hang out with any of the rest of the locker room or anything. You know, we kind of went our own way and did our own thing. The only thing I remember as far as being, like, any heat on anybody or anything was when the Michinoku guys came in and they got a spot on the pay-per-view. And, you know, while some others didn't, and I remember there was a little heat on them, but, I mean, in the end, you know, I think Paul made the right move there because, obviously, no one else in the United States was going to present that kind of match on pay-per-view, and they were absolutely sensational and brought a completely different element to ECW. But, you know, so I would never say any of these guys, like, completely fit in. Maybe Tanaka was the closest to doing so, but they were all super cool guys and everything.
Yeah, I know the other night, Rob and I watched the Hidaka match. What was the match, Rob, that we watched? It was Hidaka versus...
I think it was Tajiri versus Jerry Lynn. No? Maybe.
No,
I think Hidaka
we watched,
only
like,
came
those
in
three
for like a couple of house show swings. I don't think he ever really had a long run, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
correct.
Hidaka came
maybe,
in.
No, it was Taka. It was Taka who killed somebody. But Hidaka was super crazy.
Mr. Aguilar and Taka. CyberSlam 99, Mr. Aguilar and Taka. That was a really good match to rewatch. I didn't really like it as much at the time, but that's a really badass match that no one talked about.
Yeah, Taka was really awesome back then.
Yeah,
I thought so, too. Taka Super Crazy had a bunch of really good matches, too. But my favorite Japanese guy is Masato Tanaka, though. Like, every Masato
like
Tanaka...
Guy too.
Like, all his matches with Mike Awesome, man. Like, especially the ones Christmas 1999 and then the week after from, like, the Westchester, New York or some bullshit. But, like, they had a match in Nashville, and then they had another title, like, two title changes in a row. And for my money, even people say they're Sandy, fuck them. They're, like, my two favorite ECW matches of all time just because how fucking nuts they were. So.
Yeah, I remember both of those, and they were both really awesome matches. I mean, Tanaka was a dude who probably, you know, was a big part in making everyone think Mike Awesome was so good just because he worked, like, he was so amazing at working with them. And Tanaka could really work with anybody. I mean, there's a dude that's just a world-class wrestler in the ring.
Yeah, I remember him having some really good matches with Balls Mahoney as well, too. and, you know, really putting on shows with balls. Ironically,
can you imagine if one of those Balls Mahoney matches happened now? Like, people freaking out all over the place.
Brian Alvarez would give it 15 stars. I'm telling you, he'd love it. But yeah, like Nelson Alvarez, after they had their heart attacks, would not give that match many stars. But fuck, I love those matches. I can't even lie. Like, I'd be lying if I said I didn't like those matches. Those matches were fucking awesome.
I remember this one night in Pittsburgh, them just killing each other. Tanaka and Balls, I think it was a tag team match even, but them just killing each other with chair shots right to the head. No one would ever put their hands up on those chair shots, and they would just murder each other. And, yeah, that's not going to happen again.
No.
Yeah. Well, that's you know, like I said, I've been watching a lot of Tracy Smothers, and there were some fan cams with Tanaka versus Tracy Smothers, which, you know, in my personal humble Tracy Smothers loving self, well, some of the best matches ECW ever put on, you know, just some of those hidden gems, you know. But I'm also big Tanaka mark, whether it's an ECW or FMW or, you know, or even like just the WWE one night stand, him and Awesome having one more round at it, you know, just phenomenal guy to watch, you know.
You know what's a disappointing as fuck match, though? One of the most disappointing matches is Masato Tanaka and Doug Furness, which was a last-minute pay-per-view match when Wing Kanemura didn't show up. That match should have been so fucking good because Furness and Misawa had such a good rapport in the ring, and, like, I figured, wow, Furness and Tanaka, that's even crazier. No.
Now that you bring it up, Furness and Crawford, like, their whole run was disappointing. I remember just when they first came in, I was like, oh, my God, this is going to be amazing. They're going to be awesome against everybody. And, like, right now, the only thing that pops in my head that I ever remember them doing was something disappointing. I don't remember one of their matches or anything. I just remember nothing really being good and the whole run being disappointing.
Yeah,
and then been watching your 1980s All Japan tape saying, where are these guys at?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why they were so disappointed. I don't know if they were just shot at the time or what, but I just remember, like, being super excited when they came in and thinking we were going to have all these awesome fresh matches, and then, you know, nothing good ever happened.
Yeah, I remember really liking Furness and RVD at the time, and I rewatched it, and I did not like it again. They botched so much shit. I did not like it on a second rewatch. Now, Furness is one of those great finish guys, but I don't think I saw too many great finishes from him in ECW. Like, I think he had a match with Shane Douglas out of nowhere on one show, and that was pretty good. But aside from that, they were really disappointing. It sucks. I think their peak was probably about 2 years prior, like 94, 95. And by the time they were around, they were both pretty banged up, so I don't think they really met their potential.
Yeah, I guess I'm up to that, but yeah, I don't know why it was so disappointing. It just, I don't remember them ever doing anything good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of glad you brought up Furness and Crawford and those guys, because, you know, there are other guys that did come through ECW where you just thought, man, this would be the perfect place for them to showcase their stuff, and you could imagine them having just a huge run there. Like, guy that comes to mind for me is Marty Jannetty. You think, okay, this is a guy who parties. You know, everybody in ECW parties. So the guy could probably party in the locker room, go out, have his match, still party, and not catch a lot of shit for it. But, yeah, this is a guy that just kind of, you know, disappeared, never really made his mark there, you know. Well, what was the deal with Marty Jannetty in ECW there, Gabe?
You know, I'm trying to remember right now as you were saying that. I remember he had one match with Shane Douglas at the arena, which was disappointing. I don't think it was bad. I just think it was disappointing. And past that, I really can't tell you. I don't know what happened to him, and I don't remember anything else with him. So I really have nothing to add.
Since I'm a huge dork, I'm going to throw this out here, Gabe. You might remember this now. Jannetty had that match with Douglas, which I thought was pretty good. But then the month after, Jannetty was supposed to wrestle Sabu at the ECW arena. Jannetty flaked, so they threw Mikey Whipwreck in instead.
Okay.
And Mikey and Sabu had a ridiculous match, and then Jannetty was never heard from again. Then the year prior, Matt Bourne came in, and I thought his character was fucking amazing, but then
Matt Bourne
he played
awesome.
Too. Yeah, and then he played too, and Paulie's like, no, I'm not going to use you. And Gabe, I only bring this up because it reminds me of you, because Paulie may have instilled this. When dudes fuck you over, Paulie and yourself are like, well, even if you're an over character, a statement has to be made. You're not coming back. Do you think that might be correct? Like,
oh yeah, I remember when Sabu was you know, no showed the big three-way dance that was built around him,
mm-hmm.
for like 6 months and everything. And obviously, as you know, anyone here in the first part of this interview will know that you know how important Sabu was to the company back then, and the fact that Paulie wouldn't bring him back under any circumstances whatsoever. So yeah, I mean, that was definitely something that I learned from Paulie, no doubt about it. And I mean, it goes back, the only reason Paulie did bring Sabu back was because there was that fire incident the month before, and,
yep.
he needed something really to make people forget about the fire incident and get some momentum back. And if it wasn't for that fire incident, I don't think Sabu would have really had another run, you know. And it was a similar situation with Loki. With ROH, you know, with Loki, you know, he dicked us over. And he had actually, he'd sent word through Kettner several times trying to get back in, and I want nothing to do with him. And, of course, you know, the stuff happened with Feinstein, and we had to do whatever it took to make a comeback from that. And, you know, part of that was bringing Loki back. So it was definitely kind of a very, very similar situation that I learned from Paulie. So, you know, you deal with, like, I guess Marty Jannetty then did dick him over. And, you know, if that's the case, there would never be a circumstance where you'd have to bring back Marty Jannetty to save the company, you know, even though he was a good worker and everything. So, you know, that was it for Marty Jannetty, I guess. I guess that all makes sense. And I do remember that Douglas match. I think that maybe the expectations were a little too high for it, because I do remember it was good, but I think we were all expecting something great, and it wasn't quite great.
I'll do another nerdy parallel. Marty Jannetty would be what Teddy Hart is today.
Yeah, because they did bring Teddy Hart back in Phoenix, which Teddy Hart just called me tonight, too, by the way. So it's funny that name came up. Yeah, so...
I love Teddy. I love Teddy.
Yeah, I'll give him a call back. So, I wouldn't... I don't know if I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for him to show up at any shows that I'm booking, but I'll give him a call back. But, yeah, I mean, I guess you can say something similar to that. I mean, I'm trying to think of who a good analogy now would be to Marty Jannetty, as far as shows that I booked, but nothing's coming to mind. I'm sure there's other guys I swore I'd never use again, right, that aren't named Davey Richards. There has to be somebody. which, by the way, Davey Richards did email me recently trying to get back in and everything, so screw him. It was definitely something that was taught to me from Paulie. And, you know, it all goes back that if you're going to push somebody, and you have to be able to trust them. And, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people are like, well, why didn't you ever do, you know, Loki Samoa Joe again? And I never, you know, there's no way Loki was going over in that match, and I never trusted Loki to show up for that match. And then what happens? You know, you advertise Loki Samoa Joe and build up and make it this huge deal, and, you know, Loki goes nuts or something, doesn't show up. And there's nothing you can do to replace him in that match, you know. There's absolutely nothing you could do to save a show at that point, and you just never want to put yourself in that situation. You know, it's the same thing with Davey Richards, you know. You don't want to build a company around the guy again or give him a push or whatever, and then, you know, he's going to flake out. There's that situation, he's going to flake out again. I mean, he did it once. You know, you got to learn your lesson. Okay, you give a guy some trust, and he does it once. Then if he does it again, it's your own fault for putting him in a position to do that to you again. You know, and, you know, that's definitely something that Paulie instilled into me. And, you know, it's right. I mean, how can you trust somebody, especially when you know that, like, there's a good chance that the moment, you know, they might be good for a year, they might be good for 2 years, but when it comes to that moment that you really need them and you've really built up and you put your future and your livelihood into that person, and there's a chance they're going to flake on you, you know, because they did it in the past, and you know, how can you trust somebody to put them in that position again?
Yeah, because I remember Bourne. I'm like, if Bourne would have come back, he'd have been over, but he was just one of those guys that I just don't think Paulie could have really brought back. And you know, it's fucked up when someone's too bad to be brought back to ECW. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think ECW was romper room by any means, but, like, can you imagine? Matt Bourne.
Yeah, I mean,
man.
The guy showed up, you know. I mean,
yeah.
You know, that's the thing is that, you know, as crazy as it got, you know, everyone still showed up and made their matches, you know. And, like, a guy like Raven, I know that, you know, when he was champion, he ended up going into rehab, but, like, you know, are you really going to fire a guy and never use him again because he goes into rehab? You know, like, maybe you'll be angry at him, and And but you know, if it gets to the point where this dude had to, you know, leave in the middle of a title reign to go into rehab, like, you really do send a negative message. And if you're like, well, I'm never going to book you again because you went and tried to clean yourself up and improve your life, you know, it's not like he no-showed because, like, you know, he was passed out somewhere or was just completely irresponsible.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that was another big no-show in ECW history, where Paul obviously, you know, booked Raven after that. But, I mean, you know, you can't heal a dude for going into rehab. But when a guy just flakes on you and no-shows,
yeah.
I mean, you know, then it's difficult to book him again and have any trust. You know, trust is a big part of the booker-wrestler relationship, and you have to have that trust, especially with guys that you're pushing.
Gotcha.
Well, this might explain this, because Paul E. or somebody must have had a lot of trust in Justin Credible, because I could never understand why he was put in the position of ECW champion.
And Justin Credible actually had the best house show matches of any champion in ECW history, and I'll go on record saying that, and I saw all of them, practically, you know,
right.
or 90% of them, and night in and night out, you know, you can say maybe Justin Credible didn't connect with the crowd on the level of other champions, and I'm not really going to dispute that, but when it comes to night in, night out, like bell to bell, having the best matches and getting the crowd into it and the crowd biting on the falsies, and it didn't matter who his challenger was, like he got the fans into believing that there might have been a title change and the title was definitely in jeopardy, and he had the best matches night in, night out of any UCW champion.
Well, let me give you a different perspective, Gabe. You know, I didn't get to watch. I'm from Texas, so I didn't get to watch ECW until, you know, they ended up on TNN, right? I came late to the game. And I was so excited because I'd heard nothing but great things about this, you know, and I couldn't wait to watch the RVDs and you know, the Tazzes, and, you know, he shows up in WWF, and you know, the Sabus and all these guys that I just really saw in mags or you know, here and there online. And so when I finally get ECW and get to absorb this, it's this guy who, you know, kind of dresses like Raven, has a head like Austin, poses like DX, and uses the Undertaker's finisher. And I just could not get behind the guy. And then I'd hear his promos, and I just thought, you know what, I'm not believe in this guy's champ. And then I saw RVD, who I'd probably never seen before, and thought, wow, okay, this guy's the TV champ, but yet this other guy is the world champ? Come on, give me a break. This
well,
guy's
Paul's
the real champ.
At the time was that the TV champ and the world title, the TV title and the world title were kind of equal, and that was a big thing that he was trying to get across at the time. But I think he was building up to the big RVD win of the world title, but unfortunately Van Damme had all those injury problems stuff. You know, he had that one, I think it was a jet ski accident, and I think there was another big injury he had. So that kind of kept you know, that I think that kind of kept him from fully executing the plan that he wanted to. And, you know, at the time, too, this was when WCW and WWE were just signing up everybody. You know, I mean, Paul, you know, when ECW first started in 94, you know, 95, Paul pretty much had his choice of any available talent. You know, Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, I mean, Dean Malenko, you know, I mean, everybody was out there. Jericho, you know, you had Lance Storm, you had all these guys, and they were all out there. You know, at the same time, he developed his own talent. But then when you were talking about 99, 2000, or 99, I mean, you're really talking about a time when everyone's being poached. And, you know, so he had to do the best with what he had at the time, you know, and he had to do the best with the guys that would make him a commitment. And Justin Credible was a guy that came through the WWE system. You know, he had his run as Aldo Montoya. He didn't want to go back to WWE. He was committed to ECW. He knew what WWE was like. And, you know, maybe that bridge was burned. I don't know. But there wasn't a chance of him going back. And he was delivering in the ring, you know. I'm not going to say he connected with the fans on the level of the other world champion. But in the ring, night in, night out, he was having these great matches. So, and delivering there, and that was a big part of things. So, you know, that's what Paul had to work with at the time.
Yeah, I'm going to go a step further and say that as someone that went to a lot of the house shows live and watched all the tapes and TV, I think two guys that get shit on all the time now by the internet that were really awesome was Jerry Lynn and Credible, because those were the guys who, no matter what, they'd always have the best matches with everybody else on the roster consistently. to the point where I don't think Paulie even liked Jerry at first, but he just through hard work saw that, like, Jerry Lynn's like, this motherfucking guy is the man, and he's a player who I'm going to push. And ironically enough, the time I really thought both really peaked was when they had their little summer series in, like, 98, I think. And their match at Heatwave 98 is still one of my favorite matches of all time, with, like, the crazy tombstone off the second rope. And Just Incredible was doing all those, like, Harley Race, Shawn Michaels bumps and, like, a total pinball. And what needs to be said, too, is a really fucking good dude. Like, what an awesome guy, like, Just Incredible was. Like, anytime, the few scant times I was backstage at ECW shows, Just Incredible was always, like, the nicest guy. Which, you know.
Yeah, I don't know the guy personally. I'm only telling you what I saw as a fan.
Yeah, I know.
Who was exposed to the product at that time, you know. And, you know, I have nothing, against Just Incredible personally. I'm sure he's a very nice guy, you know. I just know that I also, at the same
like
time, I Just Incredible, I saw Tajiri, you know, kicking the fuck out of people. And I said, wow, that's the guy I want to watch in this company, you know.
I always thought Tajiri and Super Crazy could have been pushed a little bit more. I don't know. I mean, they were obviously pushed guys, but I thought they could have been pushed up to the upper echelon. You know, I don't know why they weren't. It might have been the Victor connection. And, again, you know, you have to have that trust there. And they were tied into Victor Quiñones, who, you know, you couldn't trust that much. And so it might have been that. But, yeah, I mean, I thought they were two guys. But, yeah, going back, that's just incredible Jerry Lynn series. I mean, all those matches were really, really good. And some of them were really, really fantastic. So, you know, they always delivered against each other. I mean, that was the kind of match where it's like, no matter how many times fan camming, like, I would always dump the fan cam on the Doug when it was, like, time for Mania Nova against the FBI for the millionth time on the house shows. Like, I just couldn't take it anymore. But, and not a knock on those guys, but it just wasn't my thing, and it was every show. But, like, Jerry Lynn and Just Incredible could wrestle every single show, and it never got old or boring.
Now, you know, I mean, I always argue, you know, I'm piling on them, I'm sure, you know, but it's kind of my thing. But, you know, I say that it's not X-Pac heat, it's Just Incredible heat. But I think the guys who had no problem getting any heat were the Dudley Boys. And I've been watching some of their promos before their matches, and those crowds hated the Duds. Or at least they reacted to them more, you know, with more spirit and more zest than any other act. You know, any time I've seen in ECW's history. Now, when you were filming those fan cams, Gabe, were you ever legitimately in fear of your life because of the heat that the Duds were generating?
No, I mean, I love that stuff. You know, I loved it. It was awesome. You know, when stuff starts flying and everything, I mean, it was always a great time. And back then, you know, I was younger and, you know, a little crazier. So I just, you know, I was going to Slayer shows and everything. So, you know, you put the Dudleys out there and it's like the same thing. So I love being
I just saw Slayer on Saturday night, man, so I know I'm
going to be. It was always a blast. And, like, you know, there was nothing like when all, you know, I'd move down the aisleway when all the beer showers really started and everything. But, you know, it was great, and then they start throwing chairs, and it was just crazy. And, you know, Atlas was around back then, so they didn't really fear anything. And, I mean, there were people jumping the rail. I mean, you know, I've probably booked, you know, 300, 400 shows, and we never had anyone jump the rail at anybody. You're not going to see that nowadays with the crowd nowadays. But, you know, there were people jumping the rails. And I'll admit, I stuck some thumbs in some eyes when people were being held down and everything. So, like, it was a lot of fun to be in the middle of all that. And, yeah, I mean, the Dudleys, without a doubt, got the most heel heat of, like, anybody in ECW history. I mean, maybe Shane Douglas, especially in Philly during the Gary Wolf broken neck time. Like, that was pretty crazy. But, yeah. I mean, the Dudleys were just, like, absolutely awesome. And, you know, I remember Paul, I don't think he loved it, but at the same time, he always thought it was kind of cheap heat. So, you know, I don't know what is, you know, if he was totally into it. But he would, you know, it was definitely something really, really awesome to be in the middle of. And it, you know, that's a past era. You're not going to see that anymore. It's not going to happen. It doesn't matter what, you know, what's done these days. You're just not going to see that kind of stuff again. And that was probably, you know, that was probably the last of it. You know, that was probably the last of the real old school heat. And, you know, I don't think you're ever going to see it like that again.
I will give this. I know there's some some fan cams that popped up of like CM Punk at a house show, and you know this was when he was in full on Jesus mode, you know, during his most recent run, And he was generating some legitimate heat, probably the most I've seen in a decade, you know. And nothing like the Dudleys, but still, it kind of gave me hope that, okay, someone can hate a guy enough. And then, Rob, I think you can back me up on that. I think you've seen some of that.
Definitely. Him and Jericho in, like, California with the fucking people going crazy. I think Jericho slapped some person. I think that was outside the ring, though, but regardless. But good for those guys.
Right. Yeah, and they Jericho and I think Punk were, like, pointing at fans, saying, okay, yeah, throw this guy out and throw that guy out. And, you know, but yeah, I've been watching a lot of Dudleys, too. And, you know, something that surprised me is that, you know, we think of them, you know, the Dudleys as, you know, the good talkers, whatever, you know, a lot of gimmicks. But I've seen some Bubba Wright matches that were legitimately good. I mean, can you recall any, like, just watching Bubba and say, wow, you know, he's part of some good matches that, you know, weren't
gimmicky? I mean, the Dudleys matches were good. They definitely had good matches. I mean, they had long matches. I remember one run, I think it was against, like, Spike, Dreamer, and Sandman, where they did, like, a series of six-mans on, like, every house show. And, like, they were, like, 30, 45-minute matches, you know? I mean, I remember they'd go on kind of stages. There'd be, like, the brawl stage and the heat stage and then, you know, the comebacks and the falsies and then, like, the tables and everything. But they were, you know, 30, 45 minutes, like, every single night. And they were, like, entertaining that heat the whole way through. Like, they could definitely go. There was no doubt about that.
Well, what's your thoughts, Rob, on the Duds?
I like the Dudleys. I like them more than, like, that's one of those Public Enemy deals where you've seen them since. And they kind of lose luster over the years, but I thought their promos were awesome. I loved Joel Gertner with all my heart and soul. I thought he was fucking hilarious. I liked the promo where Joel Gertner said he was going to staple $100 bill to his forehead and walk through a CD ghetto. I thought that was funny. And then he would challenge New Jack and Mustafa and all that shit. And then the dirty limericks were funny. And then, like, Bubba Ray and shit that he would say was out of control. I saw them at the Catholic Youth Center in Scranton, and that might have been the one where they got kicked out because there was some shit said that I couldn't fucking believe. It's kind of weird hearing Bubba Ray talking about, like, all kinds of crazy shit where Jesus, the cross, is the cross on you at the building. It's like, okay, shit's going to go down with this. But
that's another reason you couldn't do it. We definitely lost a bunch of buildings back then. I remember Marietta, Georgia. We lost because I think Devon said something about, or Bubba said something about Devon with like a half black kid or something like that. And one of the women in the crowd, and like that did not get over with the people who owned the building or whatever. And I remember it did incite a riot though, because that was definitely one of those shows where I had to move down the aisleway because the ringside area was just getting absolutely flooded with everything. And, there's definitely our fair share of lost buildings. But, yeah, I mean, to have that kind of heat night in and night out and just be in the middle of that was really awesome.
I feel like we could do 18 shows here, but maybe we could wind it down with this real quick. Favorite off the top of your head, now granted, favorite ECW match is ridiculous asking that to somebody, but maybe top three favorite matches, just off the top of your head, that you could think of that you've seen in ECW. And
there's Funk Sabu Barbed Wire match, the Eliminators versus Sabu and Van Damme. That I think it was like 2 out of 3 falls in November to remember. They went to like a 20-minute draw and then did another 10 minutes. Or then it was New Jack and Mustafa ran in. You know, I'm trying to think of a cool house show match.
Dude, I know one for you. That 8-man with Carino, Jack Victory, and
In St. Louis, that was awesome.
Holy shit, that's one of my favorites right there.
Yeah, that was totally awesome. Like Dusty Rhodes was in it too, and everything.
Yeah.
And that was a good little story because it was in Chicago, but it was that weekend. We were driving Dusty for some reason, and I don't know why, but. But, you know, we pulled up into the parking lot and Doug rolls down the window, parking attendant's not letting us in. And Doug's like, no, we're at the wrestling. And then Dusty comes in. So it's like, yo, Dusty Rhodes here, let us in. And the guy's like, okay, that was it. But, like, Dusty knew who he was, you know. But that 8-man in St. Louis was absolutely awesome.
But now, hey, Gabe, Rob just mentioned about favorite matches and you know, now – When you're watching ECW during those lean years, you know, and you said that like a 99, 2000, you know, their talent's being rated. But when you look at the in-ring product from those years, I'll go on record, and I'll say it. I think that out of the three major companies in the U.S., that ECW was by far the best company in 1999, hands down.
Against any other company. Crazy, Kid Cash, I mean, Guido, Mama Luke, Justin, Lance Storm. I know I'm missing a bunch of people, but, yeah.
Jerry Lynn.
You know, the in-ring, I think the main problem was, like, you know, it's hard when you lose that first generation of stars. You know, and for some reason, like, the second generation just never really replaces that first generation, and for whatever reason. And, you know, I think that was one of the problems back then is that, you know, you just didn't replace them. And then when you had guys returning from WCW, like, it just wasn't the same. You know, Sandman came back, and he got a huge pop and was over, but it wasn't the same. You know, and same with Raven. Raven came back, and it definitely wasn't the same, even though he was over. I'm not saying they weren't over, but it just, you know, it wasn't the same. But, yeah, I mean, in-ring, it was still, I mean, you had a lot of great, great shows back then. I mean, great, great matches and some great talent. I mean, Carino was awesome back then, too.
We watched, like, a December, the fan cam, that, you know, from the ECW on TNN tapings, where they had, you know, Masato Tanaka versus Mike Awesome with those title changes. And that was probably one of the best stretches of wrestling I've ever seen, you know, was that December of 1999. And, you know, it was a shame that, you know, they couldn't sustain it. But, you know, I think Rob's right. We need to shut this down. But just in closing, Gabe, who is your favorite ECW wrestler? Like, you know, not necessarily
Sabu.
The guy who personified ECW.
Sabu.
Yeah, Sabu, no
Sabu,
doubt. Before we go, I want to plug iPay-Per-View, Dragon Gate USA, October 29th from Fall River Mash, Shingo versus BB Alk announced. But we are going live on iPay-Per-View. GoFightLive.tv, DGUSA.tv, October 29th.
When's the next Evolve show?
Next Evolve show is November 20th in Union City, New Jersey, right outside the Lincoln Tunnel. So check that out, EvolveWrestling.com. We got Homicide making his debut, and all these guys that are pretty really turning the corner right now. You know, we got a lot of dudes that are really beginning to turn the corner, and it's a lot of fun to be a part of. So EvolveWrestling.com, DGUSA.tv, mark October 29th down on your calendar, live iPay-Per-View.
Yeah, as someone who's seen Evolve live, everyone get out to those shows because they are very good. They fly by. Like, that's, like, a lot of the old ECW shows flew by pretty fast, at least some of the Hamburg ones, but, like, these shows are really good, lots of action, lots of new names, fresh stars, check it out, and DGUSA, come the fuck on, man. That shit's, like, ridiculous. Everybody, if you're not checking it out, what the fuck's wrong with you? Come on. But, yeah.
Hey, Gabe, is there
yeah,
anything else you'd like
on,
to
Gabe.
Say?
Cool. No, that's about it. Do people listen this long? I mean, we've been talking for a while.
we've had some guests on that have gone 2 hours before.
Yeah,
Mark Medicine
went on 2 hours,
Gabe. Is anyone listening at this point? Is anyone listening at this point, or can I say anything right now? And, like, like that's the question I have. So if anyone is listening this long, go to my Facebook, and, Rob, give me something they can write. I don't know. Whatever. All right. Thanks for having me.
Say that you love Teddy Hart and he's your favorite wrestler of all time.
Yeah, that's right. Teddy Hart.
And you're booking Davey Richards Vinny Day now, right? Right.
Yeah. go to my Facebook and write, when are you booking Teddy versus Davey? So if you're
there
still
you
listening, please do that. So I know people listen to all talk.
Awesome, man. Thanks for coming on. We want to have you on again sometime. Love talking ECW with you, dude.
Awesome, man. Thank you.
All right, take care, guys.
Hey, it was a great show, and we hope you enjoy it. Y'all have a good night. Take care.